Saving money on your entire roofing project now at Menards. Protect your home for years to come with Owens Corning Architectural Shingles. They offer long-lasting performance while providing ultimate protection with a 130 miles per hour wind rating and limited lifetime warranty. Choose from over 50 options of Owens Corning shingles in-store and on Menards.com. And check out more of our great deals going on now. Save big money at
Menards. On this episode of The Prediction Trade, Canadian tennis handicapper and host of the Tennis Betting Tidbits podcast, John Reed, teaches us how to bet smart on one of the world's most popular sports. In addition to serving up a tennis betting crash course, he also shares how he's wagering on the French Open.
All you false pretenders and you freaky contenders, trying to be the first. In my own opinion, you are not defending. You are the worst.
Welcome back to The Prediction Trade. If you can trade it, or if you can bet on it, you can bet we'll talk about it. I'm Jeff Joseph, the editorial director of Luckbox Magazine, and I'm joined by Mike Reddy, an editor at Luckbox and the producer of The Prediction Trade. Mike, we had the Logan Paul Floyd Mayweather fight this weekend. What'd you think?
There are so many different reasons to be disappointed with that fight. I think first and foremost, when we did our podcast with Wes, we were expecting that there would be a winner. And then what, days before? I don't even remember how many days it was. But
a couple days.
Yeah, single digit number days before the fight took place, it was announced that there would be no judges and no winner. So to me, that means there's no reason to watch it. And I think that a lot of people were disappointed with all aspects of that fight.
Yeah, I was. I would be among them, and I would be as disappointed with some of the commentary I saw afterwards. A popular Barstool sports commentator declared on the internet that Logan Paul was the winner, not because he won the fight. Nobody thought he did, except, of course, his brother, but because he made millions of dollars and he worked himself into the situation where he could be up against one of the greatest boxers of all time in the ring with him so he could walk away with millions. And I guess that's the new standard now. It's about how much money you make. I don't see it that way. You know, we had Floyd Mayweather at 44, Paul at 26 years old. Mayweather, 50-0 boxing record, right? Taking the likes of Pacquiao and Alvarez and Hatton. Logan Paul doesn't have 50 now. He has 26 million followers, maybe, but and he did make it to the fourth round of the Masked Singer. Aside from that, there was no real comparison, but we all fell for it. In the actual fight, you know, Logan Paul was swinging wildly, 217 punches, landed 28. Mayweather, of course, was more precise, only 107 punches, landing 43. But clearly, you know, Paul didn't lay a glove on Mayweather that mattered, yet it didn't stop commentators from declaring Paul a winner simply because he was in the ring and he walked away with millions of dollars. But I agree with the fans in that crowd that were booing in the final eighth round, who expected to see something. We didn't see anything in that fight. That's why I like what we do on the podcast. Paul may have made millions, but let's go back to what we do here on The Prediction Trade. There's two ways to make money. There's sweat equity and there's bet equity. Let's focus on bet equity. And Mike, let's bring on today's guest.
Joining us on the show today is Toronto-based tennis handicapper, analyst, and bettor, John Reed. John is the host of the Tennis Betting Tidbits podcast, where he breaks down matches and best bets from the Women's Tennis Association to the Association of Tennis Professionals to the Challenger Tour. His 2020 record saw over 1,000 bets, netting nearly 80 units with average odds of plus 144.
Well, welcome, John. Thanks for being on.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Well, Mike, from that intro alone, there's a couple of things that I want to unpack. First of all, you know, as a spectator sport, tennis is my sport. I'm a big tennis fan. I play tennis. My son's a competitive player. I'm a over-the-top Nadal fan. I have a dog named Rafa. So all in the spirit of full disclosure, that will probably make me not a very unbiased advocate in today's podcast. So that's why we have John on. he's a true pro. But, you know, one of the things we like about this podcast is since we switched from the political trade to the prediction trade, we've been focused on essentially anything you can place a wager on. If you can trade it, if you can bet on it, we're going to talk about it on the podcast. And that means sometimes we're going to be tapping into experts that know a certain domain well, and they're going to teach us a little bit about betting in that sector, as John will today. He's going to give us a primer on betting on tennis. And then we'll look at a specific event. And of course, it's all about the French Open right now. And that's what's ahead of us in today's podcast. But what I'm so excited about having John on is not just because it's a sport and a subject that I love, and we get to talk about Rafa at some point for sure. But John's track record is really impressive. We looked at his spreadsheet, and it's always nice when a handicapper who's giving analysis and suggesting wagers and investments in speculation and betting show you their track record. And we saw John's track record, and it's impressive. It goes back several years. It's net positive. It's marked to market on a daily basis. His podcast, which is called Tennis Betting Tidbits, which I've listened to now for a couple of consecutive days. Not only is he prolific as a podcaster and podcasting new updates throughout major events like the French Open, but he is really open and honest about his track record. So, for example, today on your podcast, you talked about what you won and what you lost the previous day. So we love that kind of transparency. We love that kind of honesty. Your overall track record is fantastic. So very, very impressive. We're going to ask you more about that today. So, John, again, welcome. It's really good to have you on.
Awesome. Yeah, it's been a rough year this year. I can't, again, as you mentioned, the transparency is key. But the last couple of years were great. So I keep my head high and just keep plucking away and stick with the process that's gotten me to this point.
Well, start us from the beginning. First of all, how do you end up betting on tennis? Tell us about your background a little bit.
Well, so this goes back, I'll go all the way back to university when I studied political science. Found that generally campus life and political science is not fun. It's not a positive life. I think you guys talking about political trading, you would know that politics is more a net negative. Like there's a lot of negative emotion involved, people attacking each other. So I left that to pursue sports broadcasting, which is my other true passion in life, other than politics. And I ended up at the College of Sports Media, graduated with a diploma from there, and ended up working in sports radio. And anyone who works in sports media will tell you when, you know, you're working generally nights and weekends, because that's when sports happen, nights and weekends. So I end up working as an editor and producer at Sportsnet 590 The Fan here in Toronto, behind the scenes working mainly nights and weekend nights. So, you know, your social life kind of goes away and you're watching sports all the time. And when tennis is on every day, it kind of gives you the opportunity to sit at work and watch the sport you love. And then you start talking about betting with people around the office and you get into it for fun. I started placing, you know, a lot of parlays and just for fun bets. And then as I got involved in the social media side of things, I met a lot of people who brought me into different group chats. And, you know, I really learned how to hone my craft and approach it as if it was investing and a way to grow your bankroll and have, you know, another source of, it's not a huge source of income, obviously. I don't live on it yet. I'm not a professional bettor yet. But I do, it is a nice source of side income. And so that's pretty much how I ended up where I am now. Over the years, it's been 5 years now that I've been posting on Twitter. 3 years since I've really kept more detailed records. Before, I just had kind of the bet and the profit loss. Now I have kind of, you know, the average odds, the book, the closing line for a couple years, and more detailed records as I've gotten more serious. And it's been pretty successful. So that's how I got to this point with where I am with the tennis betting.
Well, I'm going to back you up for a moment. You mentioned politics. A couple of episodes ago, we had Tasha Carradine on, who spoke exclusively on a current market over at predictit.org, the political prediction market that we were so focused on in the first season of this podcast. And there's a current open market that perhaps you can have some insight on because of your political background. And that is, will Canada hold national parliamentary elections in 2021. When we started looking at that market, the yes price was 40 cents. I actually, as a result of Tasha Carradine's pound the table, emphatic, yes, there will be parliamentary elections in 2021. Trudeau will call those elections. I ended up buying at 48. That's what my account shows me I'm long from right now. Currently, that market is trading at 70. Mike and I are under the impression that our podcast moved the market considerably. It was a relatively thin traded market up until that point. But when Tasha was so emphatic about what she believed would be a certainty of parliamentary elections occurring in Canada this year, the market has since moved up to 70 and is sitting right about there. So we know from your bio that you've been actively involved in political campaigns. Are you still involved in political campaigns?
I don't have a contract at the moment. I actually take off all the Grand Slam fortnights because I like to do my content and I like to watch all my tennis. It's a nice, it's flexibility I like to have. Yeah.
But as someone actively involved in politics in Canada, do you have an opinion on this? Can you?
Yeah, I'm pretty bullish on Trudeau calling elections here. I think they were disappointed not to have ended up with a majority last time. They really shouldn't. I think they were surprised to win. Or at the beginning of the campaign, they would have been surprised that they even won. As the campaign went on, the conservative leaders since Stephen Harper have been notoriously weak. They probably are disappointed they didn't end up with a majority. And this is the perfect time for him to call an election. There's been speculation for about a year now. And with the vaccines rolling out for COVID, having an election during the pandemic was not something that I think anybody wanted, and I don't think anyone would have approved of. But with vaccines rolling out and, you know, your summer seasonality driving case numbers down, just like we saw last year, I do think there is the opportunity for him to call elections. I think that he has the personality. I won't use any describing traits so as not to betray any bias, but I think his personality lends to him seeing a majority and him wanting to be back in majority power. I'm bullish on that happening. And it's funny you mentioned the 70 cents because that is exactly where I would have pegged it, 70 to 75%. I'm probably not as bullish as Tasha was, but I do believe that there's a very, very strong chance he does call for parliamentary elections.
Well, thank you. We appreciate that insight. It's a market that we are active and closely following. But let's bring ourselves back to tennis and how to bet tennis in general. First of all, how long have you been betting tennis again?
Casually from 2016 through 2018. Probably it was about mid-season, so June 2016. And then much more seriously from the beginning of the 2019 season onward. Remember, tennis season, for those who aren't too familiar with it, goes from January to right through November, right? There's only about four to five weeks off for the main tours. The ITF tour, the International Tennis Federation, has, minor league tennis, if you will, to kind of put it into context. That goes all year round, right through December. But I don't really bet that. There's almost no liquidity in that market with the bookmakers I bet with, so I don't really track it. But yeah, you can get the professional tours and the challenger tour going right through from the first week of January in Australia right through the end of November on indoor hard courts. So it's a long season. So I started June 2016 through the end of 2018 casually, and then since the start of 2019, I've been doing it more seriously.
Well, I think what fascinated Mike and I at the outset of researching this topic is what we found out about the frequency of tennis wagering on a global basis. The numbers took me by surprise. Mike and I did a double take to go back and see if that's certainly the case. According to a number of online sources, tennis is cited as the second most popular sport to bet on globally, predominantly because of the high frequency of games and matches that can be bet on any given day on a global basis. And it's a easy sport to step into. In fact, Mike, any additional numbers or research to share on that?
Well, we found a 2018 independent report by H2 Gambling Capital. And they found that total regulated tennis betting back in 2017 generated $1.8 billion of gross gaming revenue. And that's just the regulated markets. In unregulated markets, the report found there was an additional $2.2 billion. The report also found that the online tennis betting market has grown substantially and it continues to be growing. Over a nine-year period from 2008 to 2017, the compound annual growth rate of tennis betting reached 28%. So it's been getting bigger and bigger.
It doesn't surprise me. I mean, and it's only going to continue as the American market opens up. And up here, we have a bill that's very close to being passed as well to regulate betting. Like, our betting is all done through offshores and unregulated markets, just because right now the provinces have a monopolistic kind of hold over all sports gambling. And in Ontario, you have to parlay three games in order to place a wager. This was an antiquated law. This might be a Canadian law, actually. I'm not exactly sure, but I know you have to parlay three games. It's a law from back in the day when players didn't make nearly as much money in professional sports, that there was the fear that if they allowed individual game betting, there would be room for, you know, the black market to kind of fix games and pay players. Now that they're all multimillionaires and then the base salary in most sports is very, very high, that worry it has subsided. Now we're going to start legalizing individual game betting, but it's going to get bigger up here as well, I believe.
Well, that law has been a boom for the bookmakers, that's for sure.
Well, the government lottery associations run it all, and their odds, by the way, their odds are awful as well. So you're getting, the hold is higher and you're forced to parlay a minimum of three games, and they know what they're doing, because if the concern was fixing matches and fixing games, they'd let you parlay two. But they know parlaying two, it's an exponential minus EV kind of play to go from two games to three games. And they know that. And that's why it's the way it is.
How about it? That's for sure. All right. So betting tennis, what are typically the prop bets in front of you? Obviously there's head-to-head matches, but what are the other ways to bet tennis? What are the over-unders, for example?
Well, you can do team totals now, but the liquidity for me and for the books I use still hasn't really developed, because it's a market that's relatively newer and that most people don't try and exploit. And because the liquidity is so low on it, it's tough to keep price integrity there. So it's something that I haven't really tapped into yet, but I'm more of an underdog better, if I'm being honest. I like my underdog money lines. You know, the intro you talked about plus 144 odds, it kind of tipped that off that I prefer the plus money wagers. I'm pretty averse to juice. I don't like laying a lot of juice, probably to a fault, and I can admit that. There are times where value is value, and a plus EV wager is a plus EV wager, but I usually sell the games and take the spread on the game lines to make sure I reduce juice. It's probably stubbornness, but that's how I approach tennis betting. I've started getting back into totals a bit more, so you can bet match totals, you can bet set totals. That's an interesting market. Although most books that allow you to bet set totals are what you'd refer to as square books. And because it's an exotic kind of derivative market, you end up getting limited or banned really quickly if you exploit that market too well.
So to be clear, set totals would be a total number of sets. So an over under on the sets. Is that right?
You can do both. You can do games in the first set. They don't release the second set, obviously, games until it's live, but you can bet on games in the first set. So to go over 9.5, to go over 10.5,
sure.
Or to go over 12.5. You can't land at 11, right? In tennis, it's 6-4, 7-5 or 7-6. There's no 11 game set. So there's no over 11.5. They just jump right to 12.5 for the tie break, or over 10.5 to go to 12 games. But, you can bet those as well. But again, as a derivative market, my podcast co-host, Snizemaster there, he got limited on that market last year at Bet365, trying to exploit that market because he was doing so well with it and the numbers were so far off. And because they don't pay attention to their derivatives as much, you can't exploit them. But again, the sharp books don't generally offer the set totals or even over under total sets to 2.5, or in Grand Slams, obviously, like we're in now, 3.5 and 4.5. Those are generally all square books. So it's really tough to exploit that if you're trying to grow your bankroll over the long term.
So, John, one of the things I appreciate about the transparency you provide your investors and your followers is that in addition to your win-loss percentage and the daily tracking of the wagers that you offer, you keep track of unit wagering as well. And units essentially are how you articulate your conviction. So a one unit bet versus a two unit or three unit bet. And each gambler is going to be different. Their units might be $10. They may be $100. They may be $200, but at least that gives you an idea of how you're performing on a dollar basis. And, you know, an indication of your value bias is looking at your 2020 record, where you admittedly had more losses than wins, a win rate of 45%, but you still ended the year up 80 units. So that kind of speaks to what you just said about being a value better, looking at longer odds.
Yeah, I think in the end, the number that matters most in this industry is return on investment, or your ROI. And to me, if I have an ROI that's up there, I win percentage for me as an underdog better. And I don't want to say this dismissively, but it doesn't matter to me. But I know it matters to other people. So that's why I include it. If it was up to me, I wouldn't even have win percentage there. But I know it's a popular metric within the betting community, even though I don't believe it should be. I still have it there for transparency, for people who do want to know. I will put it up. But again, if I'm betting at plus 150 odds, I don't need to win half the time. I need to win 40% of the time to break even. And then if I'm at 45%, I'm happy because I'm actually profiting in that situation. And that's what I've done the last 2 years. As I've become more serious about it, I've found ways to exploit underdog markets. I find a lot of the market really, really favors the big names, the favorites. They know the top players. And then when you watch the Challenger Tour for the Association of Tennis Professionals, that's the men's tour. That's their secondary tour below the ATP. If you watch them, you really start to get to know the players in that 100 to 200, 200 to 300 range and ranking. And you can really see their games. And when you can build a profile on them stylistically, you can then translate that to how they'll match up against when they do get to the professional tour. And when they're unknown to the market tends to have a bias towards the player they know, right? Not the player that, hey, this guy's never played on the ATP before. He's a Challenger Tour guy. I'm going to bet the favorite. And that kind of line movement really allows me to come in and say, well, hold on, he's very talented and he matches up well. And my numbers actually tell me that they've gone way too far. And it's not, they haven't made it more efficient. They've actually gone towards more, the market has become more inefficient as people have entered. And that's generally how I exploit and approach betting on tennis for the most part. Underdog betting is a big strength.
And that's critical what you just shared, and that's why listeners to this podcast, if they're looking for new markets and new opportunities and want to begin betting on tennis, that's why you should be following John Reed, because you just identified where the market is least efficient. And to whether it's the capital markets, financial markets, or the betting markets, that's typically what you want to find, an inefficient market. Obviously, in tennis, everyone knows Djokovic and Schwartzman and Nadal and Berrettini and Medvedev and Zverev, et cetera. That's where the money will usually flow. But there aren't many people following closely those ranked over 100. And that's where the inefficiencies are going to be. That's where the bad lines are going to be. That's where the bad pricing. That's where the expected value is. So the fact that you're tracking those players, for that matter, anybody over 30, for that matter, is getting, you know, very little action. I would think that's where you're finding inefficiencies, and that seems like the most logical way to truly exploit, as you put it, a market. So that being said, what are the bad bets? What does a new tennis bettor seek to avoid when they're wagering in tennis?
And see, this is the fun part, because I've had that experience, right? I had the experience from 2016 through 2018. Parlaying two favorites together is something I rarely do. I don't think I've done it more than five times this year in hundreds and hundreds of bets, but there is the rare opportunity. Other than that, it is for me generally one of those red flags or one of those mistake bets that you shouldn't be making all too often. It's kind of an art form though, and I wouldn't suggest a casual person do it. These are people who have watched it for years and have been doing this for ages, and go right down to the aforementioned ITF tour or International Tennis Federation. That's the minor tour. So like there are times to do it, but I think you have to be a more experienced bettor. So if you're new and you're a casual bettor, I would avoid parlays. And I know they're, you know, the casual bettor's favorite thing to do is parlay stuff. But I'm not keen on it as a casual. This is what I did. And like I said, in those 3 years, I think I lost about 10 units in 2018 or 15 units. And the other 2 years combined, I made about 30. So in 3 years, I made about 15 units as a casual bettor, doing a lot of parlays, playing a lot of favorites. And, you know, you can see the exponential growth in my records in 2019 and 2020, getting away from that and moving more so towards individual match betting and exploiting individual markets and looking for inefficiencies and essentially build something where you can understand the true probabilities.
Well, as you were speaking to that, Schwartzman just broke Nadal's serve in the second set. We'll get back to that in a moment. But, of course, we're following that closely as well.
I have the over there. So, you know, I know you're a Rafa fan, but I kind of like to see him picking up some games right now.
I think in general, over bets with Rafa are good. He, you know, he always gives you a lot of suspense. I mean, that's particularly in semifinals and finals. They're closer than a Rafa fan would like them to be, generally speaking. But so in terms of games, the over under on games versus sets, is there a preferred way to bet there? Total games or total sets?
This is actually something that I like to credit with. I have to credit co-hosts from both other podcasts, both Net Worth and Tidbits, because they have done the math for me. And on the men's tour and women's tour, there is a different line where the expected value is greater on 2.5 sets. So it's harder to quantify with Grand Slams because they only happen 4 times a year and only the men play best of 5. So I kind of want to form this in a best of 3 sets. And if we're looking at this from a probability standpoint and an expected value standpoint, they've actually calculated that after 21 or 21.5 games on the women's side, it is almost always more profitable to play the over 2.5 sets because it will always be plus money. And if they're going to get to 22 games in women's tennis, they almost always go to a third set. And the percentages line up that... again, it's more profitable and it's a better expected value wager to take the 2.5 sets at plus money than to take the 21.5 at minus 110, because there will be some matches that go over the games in 2 sets. But that discrepancy of, you know, up to 30, 40, 50 cents on the dollar makes it that it's more profitable to go with the over 2.5 sets in the long run on the WTA Tour. On the men's tour, that number is 22.5. So after 22.5 games in a best of 3 set format, you're better off going with the over 2.5 sets number. And I'm glad you brought that up, because this is something that is not actually my work. It's actually my podcast co-hosts. And because they're my co-hosts, I've learned this tactic as well. And it's something that can serve you well and serve your listeners well moving forward.
That is a fascinating tip. I'm all ears on that. I'm going to ask you to repeat it one more time just so the listeners can follow it. But that's a great thing to know. Go ahead. One more time.
Right. So when on the women's tour, if you have a total games line of 22 or greater, you're going to find more expected value in the long run. You know, I can't guarantee week to week, but in the long run, which is what this is all about, to play over 2.5 sets. And on the men's tour, that number is 23. So at 22.5, you can play the over games, but once you get 23 and greater, generally speaking, you're better going with over 2.5 sets. There is one caveat, and that is grass season, which we are entering. And I want to say that. With the men, they're obviously, the serves are very, very potent. So that's only four or five weeks of every season, though, out of, I think, 40. So that's a very, very small caveat. It's 10% of the season where that, you know, you can not pay attention to that kind of math or the probabilities there. But outside of that, on clay and on hard courts, again, generally you're looking for over 20.5 on the women. Anything above that, take the over 2.5 sets, and with the 22.5 games on the men's side.
That's fascinating. I love that. All right. Well, I think it's time for us to do is take a quick break and then come back and get right into the French Open. We're going to ask you for your exact picks, what you're looking at, and we'll take a look at the semifinals and finals coming up this weekend. So we'll be right back.
Want a little more luck in your life? Get Luck Box, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Named Best New Magazine of 2019 and 2020, Luckbox is the must-read magazine of active investors, big thinkers, side hustlers, entrepreneurs, gamblers, data geeks, and risk takers. You can buy Luckbox on newsstands, but with this special offer, receive a 10-issue digital subscription absolutely free. Visit getluckbox.com/TPT to receive the award-winning Luckbox in your inbox. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox. Learn more at getluckbox.com/TPT.
And welcome back. We're with John Reed today. John is the host of the Tennis Betting Tidbits podcast. I've listened to it several times, and I'm a new fan, and I hope you will be as well. But we really brought John on to tell us about the French Open this week over at Roland Garros. We're watching it carefully, and perhaps because of some vested interest in fandom. So to get rid of the bias that I naturally have watching men's tennis, I'm happy to turn this over to John. John, let's start with women, actually. At this point now, we know what the semifinals look like, except for some quarters that are still pending. So why don't you walk through what that looks like for us, and we're going to ask you where to place our bets.
Right. So the women's semifinals have been set. We have Anastasia Pavlyuchenkova against Tamara Zidanshik. That'll be first up tomorrow. That's 9 a.m. Eastern, 8 a.m. Central, 6 a.m. Pacific time here in North America. And then Barbara Krejcikova will take on Maria Sakkari, who today beat Iga Świątek, who had not lost a set since 2019 here at Roland Garros. So a huge upset today. So those are your four semifinalists. First time in the open era of tennis that we've had four first-time Grand Slam semifinalists in the semis at Roland Garros in Paris. So really, really cool kind of little tidbit there. Someone here.
And generally speaking, just to step back a moment, we're on clay. And when you're handicapping both men and women, you're looking specifically at the clay numbers. It's so distinct, right, than grass. And
That's actually an important thing to note as well. There's websites that allow you to break down data. You can look at hold percentages, break percentages by surface, you can also break it down against left-handed or right-handed players, because that is different as well. Some people struggle with lefties. Some people are better against them. I know for me, when I was playing, I'm a lefty. So there were some people when I was playing in high school that were really frustrated by the lefty game. Right. So it's called tennis. I don't know if you guys mind if I plug this, but it's Tennis Abstract. It's not my site. But it's a free analytics-based tennis website, and it's incredible. It's a great resource. I would say don't use it exclusively. Like, don't exclusively, you know, draw the data and plug it into a model and then bet exclusively on the model. Context and qualitative analysis is extremely important in tennis betting, but it is a great resource.
So it's good to know. So let's wrap up on the women's side. So in the two semifinals ahead, what's your preferences?
Yeah, as I said, Zidanshik money line, and then I'm going to look for I think it's priced about right for Krejcikova and Sakkari, and I'm obviously not going to try and force bets. I think at this point, Sakkari is a deserved slight favorite. She's in incredible form. She's really improved her serve. She's the most fit player on tour, and then you've got Barbara Krejcikova, who came off a title in Strasbourg and has been ripping through this field as well. I mean, taking down Sloane Stephens, who's had a resurgence this year, is very impressive. She took down, Coco Gauff, who's had one of the better clay seasons of any woman on tour in the quarterfinal. So that's really impressive. I do have to note, I am on a Krejcikova plus, 200 to 1, if you will, outright from before the tournament. So, you know, I'm rooting for Barbara there, but she's only dropped one set the entire tournament. She's beaten Alina Svitolina, Sloane Stephens, and Coco Gauff back-to-back-to-back, all in straight sets. 6-3, 6-2, 6-2, 6-love, 7-6, 6-3. I mean, only one set going beyond nine games. She is in incredible form. So I'm not going to be looking to lay juice or lay games to back Sakkari here against someone that's in form. I'm not even going to hedge here. I'm going to let it ride. I don't like to hedge if there's no value on the player I'm hedging with. I know some people like to just extract money, and extract some equity from their 201 outrights. I'm not part of that camp. I won't hedge unless I see value on the player that I'm hedging with.
I think, it's fair to say that the Krejcikova Sakkari match on, that's the second match coming up tomorrow or coming up on Thursday. Would you expect the winner of that match to go on to win the finals? How do you handicap the whole thing? Not knowing the result, of course, of the semis.
That's a fair question. And I would say, yes, I think these are the two best players left in this draw and they're playing each other. It's going to be similar when we talk about the men, right? I think we're going to get to a semifinal with the top two. So absolutely. I think it's the similar situation there.
Okay. So Krejcikova and Sakkari, Krejcikova is Czech Republic and Sakkari from Greece are playing in the second semifinal game. And again, you think Zidanshik is the preferred outcome for the first match.
Yeah, I do. I do think the value lies with Zidanshik, and it has for a long time. These kinds of runs are great to see when you're a fan of a player or they've made you money. But on the same time, it's kind of a double-edged sword, because now that she's made a Grand Slam semifinal, the world knows about her. The world knows about her game. The world knows about her talent on clay. And I'm kind of expecting to see that value dry up in the coming years now on the red clay. But, you know, it was a good run. It was a good run betting her and backing her a lot.
Okay, so there are two quarterfinals that are going on today on the men's side. Right now, Nadal is playing Schwartzman. That's live. Nadal won the first set 6-3. Schwartzman broke twice in the second set, but he's up 4-3 right now in the second set, Schwartzman. I believe, listening to your podcast yesterday, that you had the over in this match. I expect you have Nadal for the as the victor. I certainly would expect him to win over Schwartzman, but tell us how you see this.
Yeah, the over is more a stylistic issue for Nadal here. He doesn't have trouble beating Schwartzman, but he doesn't beat him with the ease he beats others, because Schwartzman can attack with depth to both corners off both wings, aka the forehand and the backhand. When I say depth, I mean right up against that baseline before the ball goes out. He can place it just inside. And that kind of can bother Rafa sometimes. He doesn't give Rafa the pace he wants. So when Rafa has to generate his own, you know, big hitting, sometimes that can go a little haywire for him. And Schwartzman's someone who's bugged him in the past. He's beaten him in Rome on clay. He took a set from him. He's the last person to take a set from him here at Roland Garros, if I'm not mistaken. I believe that Rafa's won every set he's played here since Schwartzman took one from him. I believe it was last fall.
Yeah, isn't his record at Roland Garros something like 101? Yeah, or two, right?
I think he's lost twice without, like, he's withdrawn once. I know he withdrew like 4 or 5 years back and heading into the third round. But I think it's just Robin Soderling. And I can't even name you off the top of my head the other person that have beaten him. But I know Soderling beat him because that was the year Roger Federer finally got his French Open.
Well, as somebody that prefers long odds, and Nadal never gets them on clay for all the obvious reasons. He is the king of clay. He's won Roland Garros 13 years, which is just an incredible statistic that no one ever expects will be repeated in the sport of tennis. Are you willing to lay the odds on Nadal against Schwartzman? I mean,
I do every year on the outright market, every single year. And I'll tell you, I can't stress enough how extremely poor they price him every single year, because
they do.
Barring an injury, he wins this 80%, is it 80 or 90% of the time? I think he's only lost twice without injury, and he's won 13 times. I think he's withdrawn once or twice. So if you're looking at 13 out of however many he's played, he's well over 60% of the time he's in this field, he wins. And every year, last year I got him at minus 110. I mean, I only need 53% to break even. You're telling me Nadal doesn't win Roland Garros 53% of the time? Come on. I mean, it's just an awful line. They kind of think he's getting older and he's more susceptible. Maybe that's true at Rome. It's always been true in Madrid because of the altitude where bigger hitters can get him and beat him. He's only won there 5 times versus, I think, 11 or 12 in Rome and 13 at Roland Garros, to put it in perspective. But yeah, again, every year on the outright market, they misprice him. I got a minus 120 this year. Most years are minus 110. And that is an absolutely terrible, terrible price, because you're really banking on an injury or Novak Djokovic, you know, somehow beating him in a miracle. But Djokovic is, no one's beating him best 3 of 5 on clay. You can beat him in 2 of 3. You cannot beat him best 3 to 5. One, because the longer a match goes and the longer anything goes in life, right, the probabilities kind of play themselves out, and the variance is lessened. And secondly, he wears you down physically in best of three. It's really hard to beat him there. But when you need a fourth or fifth set to beat him, you don't really have a chance, because you're so worn out and you have to use everything in your tank early on just to get a set or two off of him. Getting that third set is a near impossibility. So yeah, every year there's value on Nadal to win Roland Garros.
But later on today, Djokovic and Berrettini are at it. Djokovic had an interesting match before this. That was pretty incredible to see him down two, but that's what the true pros do. You know, if you're on the GOAT list, you expect to come back down 2-0, and he did. So the fact that Berrettini got a bye when Federer opted out and Djokovic won 5 matches or 5 sets, do you think that makes a difference today?
I do. I think that Roger Federer was playing pretty decently, and I was surprised his body held up so well through 3 matches. And I think he would have made Berrettini play a long match, because he's someone who's going to hold serve across all surfaces, including clay, often. And as a result, you're going to see longer sets. And if they split sets, you're going to see, you know, at least four. And if you've got to play at least four sets and they're all tight and you're on court for 3 hours, you know, that even if Berrettini came through, which I suspect he would have, you know, 4 hours of tennis on the body that you don't, that's no longer there. And he no longer had to exert, will certainly help him against Djokovic. This is another match I think the over is exploitable in. You know, Djokovic is just like Rafa in terms of pricing. Most he's overvalued, as much as you can overvalue him, right? I shouldn't say that he's overvalued in general, but as much as you can overvalue these two guys on clay, they generally are. The books want no part of giving anyone any opportunity to exploit them, and they want no liability on these two. So they're giving you, you know, minus 10,000s. I think Rafa is always like minus 10 to 15,000 for the first three rounds or four rounds every single year here. Like, so you can't even roll over parlay it to try and get it up, to get that those odds up. And Djokovic is similar. Although he doesn't get the Rafa treatment, he gets a treatment where he's overvalued. I think it's minus 500 right now is generally the vicinity he's in at most books. That's a huge number. So I don't want anything to do with that. The money lines there. I don't think Berrettini has what it takes to win 3 out of 5 sets. So I don't see too much value. I think it's about right at plus 400. That would imply the probabilities of about 20%. And I think that's about right. I think it's about a 1 in 5 chance for Berrettini to win. But what I do like is him to be able to either snag a set or extend to multiple tie breaks. And as a result, you know, the over 33 games is available. I don't know if this will be released or not, but, you know, minus 112 at one book I have, 33 and a half, even 34. I've got it at 34 and I've got it at 33 and a half. Because when I did my video yesterday, it was at 34 and I played it. And then when I did my podcast a couple hours later, it was at 33 and a half at an even better price. So I had to play it again. I had to re-up. If you saw value at 34, you're going to see value at 33 and a half at, you know, and you actually gain, I gained 6 cents on the dollar and a half game. So I had to re-up on it. That's where I'm at with this match. I do think Berrettini's serve clay ability and forehand will keep him in most sets. I don't think Djokovic runs away with this one. And I think that easily 55% of the time this goes over 34 games.
So Berrettini needed to pull a set and an over against Djokovic, but of course Djokovic prevailing. And now Nadal and Schwartzman are tied 4-4 in the second set. So it looks like your over is looking good there. Well, let's move on to the other semifinal that we, and then come back to the our expected semifinal with respect to these names. So that brings us with Zverev against Tsitsipas. And Tsitsipas obviously is on a roll right now, you know, on clay as well. He's looking fantastic. How do you handicap that?
Yeah, no one this year has won more clay matches than Stefanos Tsitsipas from Greece. Zverev is very, very mercurial. He is someone who can, when he's on, and especially on clay where he's most comfortable, he is just so good. He's athletic. He moves well for being 6'6". And when you're 6'6", you almost have a naturally good serve. It's tough to be 6'6" and not have a good serve. Just because you're coming, you know, that downward plane, it gives you a huge advantage. And I do believe he's far too inconsistent to really trouble Steph in this match. Tsitsipas is someone who also lapses here and there. And that has to be said, that has to be acknowledged, but not nearly as much and to the same extent as Zverev. Zverev's really shored up his double faults and giving away free points, which is key. But sometimes he gets very passive. When he's at his best, he's moving well, he's serving big, and he's using his frame and his power to really exert himself on his opponent. But there are lapses for a set to set and a half at a time where he gets very passive and he turns into almost, you know, a kind of someone who acts like he's more diminutive and needs to play defensive pushing tennis. And when he does that, he's very exploitable. We saw Steph yesterday against Daniil Medvedev. Really, really, that one-handed backhand is a work of art. It's beautiful. He loves the clay primarily because he's not the greatest returner. He has trouble really working into return games. And so when you put him on grass or on indoor hard courts that are quick, he doesn't have as much time and he really struggles. When you put him on clay, which is a much slower surface, it gives him more time to set up his ground strokes and he can work his way into return games. And that's why you've seen so much success this season on this surface. And that is very, very key for me, because if he can get into a return game or extend rallies, his inside out forehand is probably one of the best in tennis. I don't want to say the best because, you know, 5 minutes from now, I'll come up with someone else and be kicking myself. But he has one of the top, I'd say, five inside out forehands in tennis. That's to say hitting it into the corner opposite you, but on your forehand side. So it's not cross court, if you will. He's got an incredible backhand, and he doesn't lapse nearly as much as Zverev, and he's got just as big of a serve. So he doesn't lose anything in that department, which is also key. He can hold serve with the best of them. And he can break a lot easier on clay than he can on other surfaces. And again, the mental issue here is where I really find the value on Stefano Tsitsipas. I have this spread personally at 5 games. I think Steph, even in 4 sets, I think this comes down to a 5-game margin. And the books have this around 3.5 or 4. So there is definitely value there. You're getting a game of value on the spread as so long as it's available. If it gets to 5 again at -110, I'd probably leave it. But if you can find a 3.5 or a 4-game spread for Tsitsipas, I'd lay the games at -110 there. I think you have some value.
And of course, with Tsitsipas prevailing as well on that. And he does have the momentum. He certainly has the most wins on the ATP Tour so far this season at 38. And he's already, you know, he's showing his dominance on clay with, it was Monte Carlo and Lyon, I believe, right? Lyon, he already won clay titles this year. So I think, unfortunately, at some point, Nadal's going to pass that crown to him on clay. We'll get to that possible lineup in a moment, but let's step back. So you have Tsitsipas against Zverev, and you like the over on that. You see a 5-game spread. We expect the outcome of today's quarterfinals will be Djokovic and Nadal prevailing. So let's talk about that match then, Djokovic against Nadal in the semis. How do you call it?
So that again, I think I kind of alluded to it or kind of spoiled this earlier. I don't see Djokovic beating Nadal in best 3 of 5 tennis on clay. Last year was the most egregious. It was actually the largest bet I've made, I think, ever in tennis. The final, if you recall, last year.
Sure.
That had, I believe it had Nadal price when I got it at a pick'em. It was a -110, -110. And it was just one of the most irresponsible prices I think I've ever seen a book make. And I was on a combined, I think, 10 units there. And I never, ever go above 5 or like, I'll go to like 6 or 7 if I'm on different markets. So I can kind of alleviate. I don't have all my risk on one individual bet, right? If I can kind of diversify the betting portfolio on a match, I will go over the 5 units. This is one where I got up to, I think, 10, and I had the outright of 2 units on Nadal as well because it was -110. So I had a huge amount of money on the line between -1.5 sets, -2.5 sets, the money line. I was selling games on the spread. I had a variety of different wagers in, again, that betting portfolio for that match. And he won 6-love, 6-2, 7-5. Do I think he does that again this year? No. I think even I was surprised at the 6-love and 6-2 start, which pretty much brought home my minus game spreads on their own. And then the 7-5 in the third set was the kind of icing on the top of the cake that brought everything home to me. I don't see it being that dominant, if you will. I think that, you know, again, 6-love, 6-2 is a huge... It's tough to beat Djokovic. Even for Nadal, it's tough to beat Djokovic by those score lines. So I wouldn't expect that. I wouldn't go into their head-to-head and look at that and say, okay, I'm just going to go all in on Nadal. It's a different season. It's a different time of year. Remember when we're handicapping this? Last year it was in the fall due to the pandemic. Right. Those conditions are heavier. And this season it's kind of back in the spring, which, believe it or not, favors Rafa even more. So that's why it was super surprising to see those first two sets as well. Those heavier conditions are not Rafa's favorite. He likes the heat. He likes the high bouncing conditions when the ball's really popping. And, you know, you saw that, you're seeing it now this year play out. And I think the books are kicking themselves for laying a -120 because he's looked absolutely sensational.
That's right.
So I would, again, I'd have Nadal -150 to -160. And I could make a case for -200. I haven't yet run the numbers. I haven't originated my line just yet, but I would suspect that my numbers and my, you know, contextualization of the information is going to spit out a -200, anywhere from -150 to -200. And if Schwartzman takes a set here, I think even as a Rafa fan, I think, you know, it's most likely that Rafa's coming through. If you can get Schwartzman to take a set and push Rafa, that could influence some people's thinking, and the market might get a little irresponsible with that recency bias. As a Rafa fan, you probably want him to win, but as a bettor, you probably want him to drop a set in this match.
That's a good point. Give him more attractive pricing. And
yes.
Right. Yeah.
Absolutely. And again, if you get anything in the -130 If you're not going to get minus 110 again. I don't think they'll make that mistake. The market won't. I don't think the books will either. And you see Schwartzman has a set point as I'm speaking through this. So, you know, this could be important. But yeah, I do think that if you can get anywhere in the minus 130 or better range, that is, it's probably a multi-unit wager for me. Again, I haven't, full disclosure, I haven't yet run the numbers because it hasn't been set and the line's not out yet. But I would suspect I'm going to get something. I know my numbers will spit out something heavy on Rafa. I love him every year in the outright market. And against Djokovic, I generally find that the books give me an attractive price on him.
Okay. And of course, that sets us up for the final, which would be Tsitsipas against against Nadal as our projected final. Of course, we don't know that to be the case yet with these two pending outcomes. But how would you see that fight? And of course, that's with the backdrop of another 14th win potential at Roland Garros again, which would be unprecedented. And more importantly, Nadal taking the lead over Federer in Grand Slam victories, 21-20. So he has a lot to play for career-wise. You know, he's likely winding down toward the end. This could even be close to a final chapter, maybe another year, another year or two at best. But this is clay. This is his world. This is his time to surpass Federer in the all-time GOAT list on the Grand Slams. So how do you call it?
Well, I'm gonna first say that I would put my money if there was a market on who ends up with the most slams on Djokovic, just yes, because there are three on other surfaces. Yeah. And the age, he's a year or two younger. He has three surfaces that he's gonna dominate on compared to one for Rafa. But in terms of that final, this is a lot like the semifinal potential I mentioned. I'm gonna have numbers that favor Nadal big. I think there will be recency bias, or not recency bias. He's been doing it consistently. It's not like one or two matches on Tsitsipas. I do think that people will look at his season. He beat him in Australia, if you recall, again, but that's a completely irrelevant number to me. But the market, this is something that's important for newer bettors too. If you can get up to speed on tennis, the market is probably one of the least efficient of any sport I've ever seen in terms of betting. They will look at Tsitsipas beat Rafa in Australia and let that influence their decision. Australia has some of the quickest courts in the world, and it's a different surface. This is one of the slower courts, and it is a totally different surface. One's a hard court, one's clay. They're night and day, right? So I do think you have a chance to see some head-to-head bias there. It's one of the biggest things I'm a proponent of. I have been for years saying, don't look at the head-to-head numbers. Too much data is irrelevant. Matches from years ago don't matter anymore. Matches on different surfaces don't matter. When you're doing your handicap, it's one of the biggest mistakes some people make to go back to what we spoke about earlier, is looking and overvaluing head to head. I don't even look at it, if I'm being honest, because if there's a dominant head to head, I will spot that in the matchup style analysis, right? The qualitative analysis I put into every match. I'll generally spot a big matchup discrepancy between two players, and that sometimes leads to a gigantic head to head advantage for one player. But back to the match, I do think that Tsitsipas will be overvalued. It would be my prediction. My numbers love Rafa. Again, like, this is even going further out that I haven't originated my number yet. But I do think this, it would be, again, a minus 200 number. I do think that he should be lined the same way against Djokovic and Tsitsipas. I think Tsitsipas is really closing the gap on Djokovic. And because of his form, he deserves more respect this year because of his clay court season than Djokovic. But Djokovic has the pedigree, he has the return game, and he's just better all around than Tsitsipas. So I think they've each got something that to make the case that they deserve to be priced better than the other. But in the end, I think it should be about the same pricing. And I think, again, we should see value on Rafa in the final. And I'm excited. It's rare that I get to bet him multiple times at Roland Garros in the individual match market. So I'm really, really hoping that we do see that. And, you know, he dropped the set that I was hoping for. He did drop a set to Schwartzman. Schwartzman has done this to him a lot. He takes sets from Rafa a lot. And it comes down to that style matchup for him, right? His style pesters Rafa. So the over, barring a retirement, if there's a retirement, it would be annoying, but barring a retirement, the over's in, which is nice to see. Again, Rafa has value for me against Djokovic and Tsitsipas at anything minus 135, minus 130 or better. I would say even minus 14. Yeah, minus 135, minus 130. I would probably be on him relatively heavy.
Well, that's the big call. You have us on pins and needles. Of course, Nadal's doing the same. As you said, Schwartzman won the second set, which means you've locked in your over, which you called for on your podcast just yesterday. And we still expect Nadal to prevail in that. We have your winners. We have your picks. We'll see how it all plays out. Listen, it's been fantastic having you on. You truly know this sport, and as a fan who follows the sport carefully, your analysis and underwriting really resonates with me. So I really invite all of our listeners to tune in to the Tennis Tidbits podcast, Betting Tennis with John Reed. You can find him at Tidbits Tennis, T-I-D-B-I-T-S, Tennis, on Twitter, also JR Tweets Tennis. JR Tweets Tennis and Tidbits Tennis. His podcast is Tennis Betting Tidbits. It's wherever you listen to podcasts. And John, thank you so much for coming on. We've got our fingers crossed, and love to know that you're betting the same way we're hoping for in terms of the outcome, and look forward to having you back.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I always enjoy discussions based in more investment kind of approaches to things and looking at data and probabilities more so than just pure gambling. So it's nice to have that conversation. Thanks for having me.
Just off the cuff right now, I would consider John to be one of our more knowledgeable guests on his topic. So that was great to have him on. Mike, where do we go from here?
Well, Jeff, just one quick announcement, a reminder, if you will. If you want the insights of a lot of people knowledgeable about Amazon, well, the latest issue of Luckbox magazine is available. Get that for free in digital format at getluckbox.com/TPT.
I hope we give people a lot to think about before they plop down their money on Amazon Prime Day coming up later on this month. So, yes, pick up Luckbox magazine. It's free in digital format. And that's all we have for this episode of The Prediction Trade. And if you like what you heard, please tell your friends about us and make sure that you subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts. Check out thepredictiontrade.com to sign up for the newsletter, find us on social media, or send us a message. And of course, you can find The Prediction Trade column in print in each issue of Luckbox magazine. Go to getluckbox.com/TPT. to read the latest issue of Luckbox digitally for free. So thank you again for joining us. This is Jeff Joseph.
And I'm Mike Reddy.
And remember, always wager responsibly, believe in math, master your trade, and join us next time on The Prediction Trade.